This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Whose vote counts in North Carolina? It's a question that residents of many communities across the state have been asking for nearly a decade. In recent years, courts have determined that Republican lawmakers illegally gerrymandered congressional and legislative districts in North Carolina. Those maps provided an unfair advantage to the Republican Party and disenfranchised black voters. Joining us to walk through some of the state's redistricting history are David Daley, author of the books Rat Effed, The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy, and Unrigged, How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy. Dave, welcome to the State of Things.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
Tomas Lopez is with us, Executive Director of Democracy North Carolina. Tomas, welcome.
Hi, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. Let me stay with you. We get the 2010 census data in the year 2011. The Republicans are in charge. New congressional and legislative maps were drawn. So talk about the 2012 election and what that looked like and how, you know, in many ways, just a quick snapshot of that election told us all we needed to know about how those maps were redrawn. What happened in that election, 2012?
I'm sorry, Frank, I'm happy to speak to that, but if you were going at David on that.
Well, oh. David, I guess I could put the question to you as well. You could give us a sense of the 2012 election and what that told us about redistricting in North Carolina.
Certainly. What you saw in North Carolina and what you saw nationally in 2012 was the effect of the lines that had been drawn the previous year. 2012 was a fairly Democratic year nationally. You get Barack Obama reelected, and yet Republicans are able to hold on to control of Congress, 234-201, even though they win 1.4 million fewer votes nationwide. And if you look at this at the state level, it is all the more convincing. All of these close states, a relatively, you know, purple 50-50 states like North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, Florida, states that were extraordinarily competitive, what you begin to see is upwards of 70% of the congressional delegations going to the Republicans, even when the vote total is relatively 50-50. And you see the same thing in state legislatures. The total vote count in 2012 by party is very, very close in North Carolina, both for Congress as well as for the Assembly. And yet Republicans are able to take big majorities, and they have not relinquished those majorities yet on these maps. Indeed, Republicans have held on to those majorities in all of those states all decade long. Based on the skill and the intent with which those lines were drawn and devised.
Yeah, despite winning, you say it was very close, and it was, although the majority went slightly to Democrats in that election, very slightly, and yet only 4 of 13 congressional seats went to Democrats. So that gives you some sense. So talk about how that happened, because the Republicans were quite deliberate about targeting the year 2010, and apparently the Democrats didn't see it as so important. Talk about the way in which both parties strategized over the year 2010.
Yeah, Democrats really fell asleep in 2010. I think because Democrats had a terrific year in 2008, and in many ways, this is a story of three elections. It's a story of the 2008 election in which Democrats win the White House, a supermajority in the U.S. Senate, and the demographics of the nation begin to change in such a way that a lot of people looked at that year and said, "This is the beginning of an inevitable Democratic coalition based on the way that the nation is changing." And Republicans needed a path back to power after this in 2009 and 2010. And what they realized was that as historic a year as 2008 was, 2010 had the ability to be that much more consequential. It was a census year. It's a redistricting year. we redraw all of the state legislative and congressional maps after the census. So election years ending in a zero are just that much more meaningful as far as total control is possible. And so Republicans focused in on 107 specific state legislative seats across 16 states, including North Carolina. They called this plan Red Map, which is short for the Redistricting Majority Project. And they invested $30 million in these down ballot state legislative local races because they understood that those local races really had outsized influence, both with regard to map making authority that would be on the line that year, but also with regards to the kind of conservative policies that they would be able to push through if they won control of all of these state legislatures at a time in which Barack Obama was in Washington and power nationally was fractured and divided. The opportunity for unified conservative control in the states represented another path toward power. And indeed, what we've seen was that based on that big year in 2010, Republicans have been able to keep control in all of the successive years. So 2014 in North Carolina, right, is a pretty big Republican year. The congressional maps are 10-3. 2018, a pretty good Democratic year in North Carolina, and it's still a 10-3 Republican map. Nothing budges.
So this kind of map making is legal generally, although the North Carolina legislature managed to push it too far and actually get flagged for political gerrymandering. But Tomas, gerrymandering is by itself is not a new concept, and it's something that both parties have done, right? Tell us a bit about gerrymandering's history in the state of North Carolina.
That's right, Frank. One of the things that folks should understand about gerrymandering is that it's not at all a new process. In fact, I think as many people who are listening probably know, right, that the name goes back to an early 19th century politician named Gary with a hard G. And so the process of manipulating legislative lines for political gain in one way or another is not a new one. But what we saw in the 2010s, you know, both nationwide and particularly here in North Carolina, was really that process level up. I think what David talks about are the ways that elected officials used data, use technology to draw lines at levels of precision that were just not possible in prior decades. And so if you look at the legal history in North Carolina, you can see that Democrats have gerrymandered, Republicans have gerrymandered. But really what we're looking at, you know, over the last 10 years has been an effort that has really had a level of, again, kind of extra precision that's allowed it to be particularly effective. And what we've seen is a little bit of a game of whack-a-mole, because the redistricting process is supposed to happen once per decade. But because of all of these attempts to get around the rules against racial gerrymandering, against partisan gerrymandering, we've gone through several maps in North Carolina, up to the fact that we will have this year maps that are being voted on for the first time that we'll only have them in this election because we're going to have new maps being drawn in 2021.
Well, let's look at the history of that a little bit, the legal history. By 2013, there's a federal lawsuit brought that challenges two congressional districts in violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, Tomas. So tell us about that clause and how that legal battle played out.
Sure. One of the things that people should understand about the law around redistricting is that many of the cases that have been brought over the years are based on the idea that you can't discriminate against people on the basis of race when it comes to voting. And that one of the things that the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment provides is that there is this representational interest that people have. And so if you have these maps that are being drawn in a way, and there are also statutes, you know, laws like the Voting Rights Act that speak to these issues, you have this end result of black voters in particular having their votes matter less than white voters in particular. And so we see with the first wave of lawsuits that were brought in North Carolina in the first half of the decade, that courts were finding that, in fact, this was an unlawful racial gerrymander. And racial gerrymanders in North Carolina go back several decades when it comes to that. And so in that way, that wasn't the new thing, where we end up going is in new territory when it comes to the idea of a partisan or political gerrymander.
But let's talk a little bit more about the racial and racial redistricting, Dave, because in some ways there's a somewhat lower threshold. If I have this right, you can look at the results of a racial if you're talking about racial gerrymandering, you can look at the effect, whereas if it's political gerrymandering, you have to talk more about intent. And yet, in this racial redistricting case, intent was more or less easy to demonstrate. Talk about the role of Thomas Hoeffler.
Thomas Hoeffler,
yeah,
the key Republican operatives that has helped create the nation we live in, even though we don't really necessarily know his name. And really what Hoeffler was so good at as a Republican mapmaker, what made him so valuable is he understood the Voting Rights Act and all of the laws around racial gerrymandering so clearly, and he would walk as close to them as he possibly could. And obviously, in some cases in North Carolina, courts found that he crossed those lines. But he would he was so good at maximizing and really weaponizing laws that were intended to protect racial minorities and assure them representation. He was really good at turning those into weapons that actually enhanced Republican representation. And there's a really easy reason why, right? Because whenever you draw a line, it means that there are people on one side of it and people on the other side of it. And if you can draw Democratic districts in such a way that you pack all of the most likely Democratic voters into as few districts as possible, you are able to make all of the surrounding districts more advantageous for your side. So Hoeffler, his goal would be to pack as many Democratic voters as he could into as few seats as possible, and then to scatter and crack the remaining voters and to dilute those the Democratic votes across a wide number of districts. And that's how you can end up with a map that remains 10-3. He was really able to weaponize the combination, I think, of Thomas Hoeffler and David Lewis, the chairman of the redistricting efforts in the House, is that they were able to turn the law on its head a little bit and to sort of exploit the tension between a racial gerrymander, which courts have often disallowed, and partisan political gerrymanders, which courts had not developed a standard on. And because most Democrats are, because most black voters are Democrats, because of this kind of polarized political environment, they were able to say, well, we're just doing an old-fashioned political gerrymander over here. The courts have nothing wrong with that. When in reality, what all of their hidden documents showed was that, oh, no, they were actually doing a racial gerrymander.
Yeah, talk more about those documents and what they showed and how they played a part in this unraveling when it finally came time to take it to court.
Yeah, I mean, what you would see, and I got access to all of Hoeffler's files at some point about a year ago, and a lot of these files were also introduced in the partisan gerrymandering case in North Carolina in 2019. And what they show is that he was very much aware of what the racial impact of all of these lines would be. There were maps that would show that were written on them very clearly what the racial percentage of each of these districts were. But if you go back and if you delve even deeper into the files, I mean, I came across things like spreadsheets that included the home addresses of tens of thousands of college students in North Carolina, as well as whether or not they had a driver's license. So this would mean Hoeffler, as he was drawing maps, would know whether or not the college students in these voting districts possessed the kind of specific ID that Republicans in the gerrymandered legislature had required that voters have. So as he was drawing and redrawing lines across this decade, indeed, as he was drawing a line in Greensboro that actually, you know, bisects a North Carolina A&T and puts six dorms on one side and seven dorms onto the other side, they knew at a precise granular level who lived on which side of these lines, and they were using that information to try to enact an enduring partisan advantage.
Tomas, in 2016, the maps were redrawn again following a court order to remedy racial gerrymandering. Were these maps any more equitable?
Well, before, they weren't, and they're ultimately problematic, but I just want to put a finer point on one of the things that David just raised, and it was the way in which these gerrymanders in the first part of the decade, and I think we see this throughout the country, really tried to leverage the protections that exist in the law for representing the voices of voters of color. So what we saw was in that packing process, right, it is about minimizing the voting power of black voters ultimately, but the law itself can be read as giving a fig leaf for that. And what they were trying to do was to say, well, we have created these districts where voters are able to elect their candidates of choice. Isn't this great? And it's one of the reasons, right, that speaks to, kind of the ways in which the redistricting process itself is flawed. Now, what we saw in 2016 and what followed was that we ended up having maps that, while somewhat better than the ones in the first part of the decade, still ended up going to court, still ended up being problematic. And so while you may have not have had some of the really wild distortions that we saw previously, there was substantial evidence that multiple courts found that, in fact, we had maps that were also political gerrymanders. So while lawmakers like David Lewis were saying, we are intending to draw this map to have 10 Republicans and 3 Democrats because we can't have 11 and 2, there was a really full-throated legal effort to try to say, actually, that's not lawful either. And those ended up working its way both up the federal and the state courts.
Well, let me ask you, Tomas, if we've seen what, and of course, it's been going on for decades, and the Republicans are responsible in this past decade. The Democrats have been no friend to African-American voters in this state when they were Dixiecrats, segregationists, and doing everything they could to disenfranchise black voters before the party alignment shifted in the 70s. So the Democrats are not off the hook. But in this current time, it's the Republicans' turn to do it. The question I have is, what do voters take away from this? Have voters who have been disenfranchised for a decade in this state, how do they feel? And can they approach the polls with any confidence that their vote counts?
I think ultimately what people should feel like in terms of this year, right, is that we do have maps that are, again, an improvement on what we had before. Right, we had a North Carolina state court find that there were partisan gerrymanders unlawful under North Carolina state law that have led to maps being redrawn here, right? So that is some form of progress. Do we think these maps are perfect or ideal? No. Are they better? Yes. Where this points forward is next year, and as you said at the top, the lawmakers that are elected are going to draw new maps. And I think it's a real moment at that point next year for accountability. Because one of the things we know is that when people run for office, they run as reformers, right? They run, especially if they're not in power, they say, I'm going to do things differently. I'm going to be more honest. I'm going to be more transparent. And there is an opportunity to whoever wins this election, whoever is in control of the map drawing process, to actually hold them to account for that. One of the things that's important in North Carolina is that the process is held exclusively by the General Assembly, by both legislative houses. The governor has no role in the redistricting process. And so what that means is that it really comes down to who's running the Senate, who's running the House, and how are they working together?
I'm going to cut it off right there. Tomas Lopez, Executive Director of Democracy North Carolina, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
David Daley, author of the books Rat Effed, The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal American Democracy and Unrigged, How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy. Thank you for being on the program.
A pleasure. Thank you.
You can find more at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, a look at the long-term effects of gerrymandering on the State of Things. Don't go away. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, and as we said, voting maps in North Carolina were redrawn in 2019, but the long-term impact of this past decade's districting disputes continues to affect North Carolina's black communities. Now that the 2020 election is underway, many potential voters are reminded of the state's recent history of racial gerrymandering and that the history affects voter trust and voter turnout, and that turnout is especially important this year. Valerie Fucci is a Democratic member of the North Carolina General Assembly. She represents the 23rd District in the North Carolina Senate. She also serves as chair of the North Carolina Black Alliance's Board of Directors. Senator Fucci, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you, Frank. Happy to be here.
Good to have you. North Carolina's Black Alliance has launched a voter safety protection campaign called Safe Voter NC. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, absolutely. We are proud that we have been able to pull together our resources to provide a plan to get out to voters, particularly voters in communities of color, to press upon them the importance of voting in this election and that it is safe to vote in this election, that each of us should have a plan to vote and that we should operationalize that plan without fear. And so we have been able to distribute PPE kits so that people have masks, that they have their own pen, and they have antiseptic wipes to ensure that they are safe when they go to the polls to vote.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. We've been talking about human means and human desire to suppress the vote, and then along comes this virus, so that has to really complicate things. Historically, black voters have favored in-person voting. Can you tell if that sentiment has changed now?
I don't know that that sentiment has changed, Frank, but I do think that with the pandemic, there are voters who have to ensure their safety because they are part of vulnerable populations. We know that this virus has disproportionately affected people of color, African Americans, and Latinx people. And so we need to make sure that if we're not going to vote in person, that we have requested an absentee ballot, that we can indeed mail that ballot, or we can take it to a polling place and hand it over, or we can vote early where we're less likely to be in a crowded situation, more opportunities to determine when you go to a polling place to vote. So again, the focus is on having a plan and then being sure to operationalize that plan.
Yeah, that early voting does offer an opportunity to be able to vote with fewer people around you. But let's stick with the mail-in ballots for a moment, because there's been some research that showed in 2018, for instance, mail-in ballots from black voters were more likely to be rejected than those from white voters in North Carolina anyway. So has that concern been expressed and the concern about black voters in this election cycle?
It has, and we are also reminding people that they need to ensure that they follow the instructions, particularly as it relates to having that ballot signed by a witness, by an eligible witness. And so there is a movement to make sure that those ballots are completed correctly and that they are returned correctly.
I know black voters make up 46% of the Democratic Party membership in this state, and they're the largest racial group among Democratic voters. So talk about the importance for this election and whether or not that's part of your appeal this time around and your sense among all voters, but I know that you're focusing on African-American voters, about the importance of this particular year.
Well, I think going back to what we've heard on the previous segments, we know that this is indeed the most important election of our lifetime. The whole talk about what happens now after the census and understanding who is going to be drawing the lines, not just for congressional districts, but indeed the legislative districts, understanding that this being a state that's almost 50-50, the lack of representation of the majority of North Carolinians is something that should stick out in the minds of everybody, that what we have now in the General Assembly is not a true representation of the people, and particularly as it relates to communities of color. What we have now is a system that perpetuates or exacerbates, you can use either word, the systems of class and race in our state. And so what we have now is a General Assembly that has voted to not expand Medicaid, a General Assembly that has not held a vote on raising the minimum wage to $15 per hour. All of these things affect communities of color as it relates to housing, as it relates to education, the lack of health care or the lack of access to affordable health care, and the inability to build wealth.
Finish that thought, please.
What we have is a General Assembly that does not allow for the issues of concern for a large segment of our population to be heard, and certainly not to be addressed.
It's interesting, though. It seems like a double-edged sword. On the one hand, when you make the case effectively that you as a class or a group have been underrepresented, deliberately so, by the actions of this General Assembly, on the one hand, it may engender a motivation. It may make you want to get out. But part of the goal, the motivation on the other side, is to tell you you don't have a chance. You don't have a voice. Your vote doesn't count. Is that an uphill battle? Do you have to sort of struggle against the fact that they've been so effective? Your vote hasn't counted up until now, but this time it will? Is that a struggle?
It is a struggle, but I think what is clear is that in this moment, when you consider how the pandemic has affected communities of color, when you consider the social unrest in this nation, what you have is an understanding and a revelation of what has gone on and what will continue if indeed we don't exercise our right to vote and change the face of power in our legislatures and in Congress. And so what I think you're going to see is that people who have been disenfranchised, who now see themselves being categorized in many situations as essential workers, but yet they don't have the ability to affect what happens with minimum wage. They don't have the ability to affect what happens with their health care. We are seeing now, as a result of what the pandemic has done, is a revelation of how we continue to be misrepresented and how we continue to be disenfranchised in a system that was not designed to help. When we think of the government is supposed to help you, not do things to you to affect your ability to have the same access to the dream as others in this country. And so even when you look at what the pandemic has done for education in our state, the pandemic has laid bare the inability for some folk to even have access to broadband. And so if I can't have my child to be able to log on with his or her classmates, then that education is being affected, which will have long-term effects on job employment, on housing, and everything else. It's all connected, and it's all based on whether or not you take advantage of your ability to cast that ballot and indeed influence the outcome of elections.
You were one of three sponsors of a nonpartisan bill called the North Carolina Citizens Redistricting Commission Act. Tell us about the details of that bill, will you?
Well, the details of that bill, first and foremost, sets up the ability for our Constitution to be amended such that an independent redistricting commission can be established so that when the lines are drawn after the census that they are not drawn by legislators who will take the opportunity to either protect their seats or to make sure they can protect their majority.
Give us a sense, and also an independent commission to draw the district maps, right?
Oh, absolutely. That is the purpose, that that commission that is not packed with legislators
right.
will, in a nonpartisan fashion, draw districts that we believe would be much fairer than what we've seen over the last century. Because, as was noted before, we know that both parties have taken advantage of the redistricting process.
What this is being done in other states? I don't know if they've actually acted yet, but I think it's in effect in California, right? Is one place? Do you know where else it might be in effect already, and whether or not we've seen the results of this kind of nonpartisan redistricting?
I'm not sure of any other state except for California. Mm-hmm.
Well, we know that racial redistricting does result in when it's done, it's so far in this state, has meant unfair representation for black communities. How does it show up in daily life? You've talked a little bit about not receiving resources and support. And again, the idea that there's a underrepresentation. What are some of the other ways that not being represented shows up in daily life?
Well, I think the most important ways are with the top three, healthcare, education, and housing. The fact that we don't have access to resources that will allow for a college education or community college education such that your employment can move you beyond minimum wage. The idea of raising the minimum to $15 per hour is not a huge thing, but to consider that people making $7.25 an hour can afford housing in just about any county in this state is ridiculous. That you can feed your children off of wages of $7.25 per hour, that you have to make decisions that determine whether or not you're going to be able to pay for medical insurance, because the fact is, if you are in a minimum wage job, you are not being employed by someone who helps subsidize your health care or insurance premiums. All of those things affect the quality of life. And again, the ability to build wealth is not there if you cannot save. If all of your income is going to whether or not you can have decent housing, you can provide for medical insurance, you can provide for your children being able to access all of the opportunities that come with education in this state, does not create a path for you to be successful, for you to have a part of what we have always called the American dream, and a path to generational wealth.
You know, we talked earlier about the impact of gerrymandering, particularly up at North Carolina A&T, split the campus right in half, a deliberate
Absolutely.
Act to split the vote. Well, and I know that you're doing outreach. HBCUs obviously have been affected. Have you been able to take the temperature there and the idea of or the energy behind voting this year among college students?
We see college students are energized, that they are ready to mobilize, and that they are going to indeed make sure that their peers are taking the opportunity to have their voices heard and to influence this election. So we're excited about that. We are seeing that happen at all of our HBCUs right now.
And again, let's take a look at the couple of factors that we've talked about that can repress the vote. Certainly, because of the pandemic, fears about, and you talked about the ways in which you're reaching out to communities to try to ensure safety and also ensure that votes count. What are you hearing back? Let's talk about the pandemic in particular. Are people expressing some fears and suggesting that they might not vote this cycle because of that?
I'm not hearing that, Frank. Now, I'm not saying that that is not the case, but what I am seeing and what I am hearing is that as we see more of how this pandemic is impacting communities of color, how we see that there is not leadership that is moving to provide safety and to ensure that everything that can be done will be done to help us move past this pandemic so that when we talk about reopening and we're talking about a comeback, that there's a comeback for everyone. I don't think that there are many people who don't see this as the most important election and that they want to be a part of the changes that are bound to come.
Valerie Fushi is a Democratic member of the North Carolina General Assembly, represents the 23rd District in the North Carolina Senate, also serves as chair of the North Carolina Black Alliance's Board of Directors. Senator, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.